Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
It was a harrowing ambush. A Sky News team on assignment in Ukraine, coming under fire, not knowing from where or who or why. The chief correspondent, wounded, not knowing what was going to happen next. Now, a month later, he is recovering, and he's here to tell the story. So, let's go ahead and cue the music. I'm Brian Stelter, and on this weekly Reliable Sources podcast, we have a chance to go more in-depth, talking with media leaders and newsmakers about how the media world works from the inside. And as you know, the past month, now more than a month, of the war in Ukraine has been incredibly costly for civilians and also for the journalists who are there to cover the war. Sky News came under fire early on. This was essentially in the first week or so of the war. And when the video later came out, it was shocking to see chief correspondent Stuart Ramsey wounded right there while trying to cover the story. His camera operator also took on two rounds to his body armor. And we haven't heard a lot since about what that experience was like and how much worse it could have been. Stuart's been recovering, and he is now able to join us. Sky News chief correspondent Stuart Ramsey with me, along with producer Dominique Van Heerden. Thank you both for coming on and sharing your stories. Stuart, how are you feeling today?
Pretty good, actually. The wound seems to be healing quite well. The stitches have been taken out. The operation was quite painful when it happened a week or so ago. But the doctors say a full recovery. They also do say I was extremely lucky. I mean, there's no doubt about that. This bullet came in and went straight through me and straight out again, which is, of course, actually a blessing. And so there was no sort of extra injuries caused, which would have been very nasty. So, you know, I'm feeling pretty good and very, very glad to be here.
Feeling lucky, it sounds like.
Oh, we were very, very lucky. You know, this is an absolute miraculous escape for all of us. Five people in a car. Bear in mind, this is a bit like sitting at a sort of kitchen table, if you like, being shot at pretty much continuously for 3 minutes and 20 seconds or so before we were able to get out and escape down an embankment. I think if you actually look at it like that and say, would you sit in a car for 3 minutes and 20 seconds while we fire two machine guns at you, you would think there was any chance you could get out. And I have to say that all of us since have said we actually pretty much didn't think we were going to get out. So it is absolutely miraculous. And you know, we're very fortunate. I think the real point to remember here, Brian, is that the reason why we've shown this story was because it's happening to ordinary people all the time. There's nothing exceptional in the attack upon us. What's exceptional is that Richie Mokhtar, our cameraman, filmed it all. That's what the difference is, because this is happening all the time. And so this is why we put this story together. And Sky News looked at this very closely for a long time to see the editorial merit. And that is the reason why we put it to air.
That's a really interesting point. You all shared this on the air on March 6th, but it happened earlier. So, Dominique, take us back. What day was this and where were you all going?
It was the last day of February, the 28th of February. And, you know, Ryan, what you know and what other journalists covering this story understand is that it's actually, when you're in Kyiv, in the capital, it's actually quite difficult to tell the story of the war because, you know, aside from the distant booms and bangs, you know, in the city center itself, it's still pretty much a fortress. And it was the first day after a two-day curfew that had been in place in the capital. We had just received new accreditation from the Ukrainian armed forces to go and cover, you know, Kyiv and the outskirts and that sort of whole region. And so we were aiming to go out. We were planning to go to Bucha, a town, you know, 20, 25 miles from the city center. And the previous day, a Russian convoy had been taken out by Ukrainians. And we had great contacts inside the place, and they said, come on over and we'll show you the convoy. And we thought, well, good, you know, finally we'll see a little bit of the remnants of war. So we set out that day knowing we'd have to navigate loads of Ukrainian checkpoints, and that took hours and hours. And bear in mind, we were going somewhere that should take 30 or 40 minutes maximum on a normal day's drive. It got to around, must have been around 3:30, 3:45 p.m. And we started to look at our watches and we still weren't in Bucha. That's how long it was taking us. And we could sense that the fighting was starting to increase. And although we were in Ukrainian territory and we were behind Ukrainian lines, we felt that the intensity of the fighting was somehow going up a tick. And we started to feel a bit uncomfortable and made the decision, and this is the irony of it, we made the decision to go back to the city center for safety reasons before it started to get dark. We came to a crossroads, you know, where we had earlier gone right and round. And this time we could see, I couldn't tell you how far, but it was close. It must have been at least, you know, maybe a kilometer away to our right. Two Russian attack helicopters that were up in the air and they were circling very low. And so we felt we could not go back, you know, that same route that we'd come, because you don't want to be a lone car on an empty road with attack helicopters in the air, obviously. So we spoke to the police at the checkpoint and we spoke to the soldiers. They were very relaxed. They gave us ice creams, bizarrely, which they'd been given by citizens. And they said, thank you so much for the work that you guys are doing. We appreciate journalists. We appreciate everything that the British public has done to help us and all that type of thing. And it was a very relaxed conversation. And we said to them, right, so how can we go out of here safely without having to go the way we came? And they said, well, you go left, you know, 300, 400, 500 meters, and then you take a right. And we said, great, thanks very much. We took a left. We drove, couldn't have been more than 400 meters down the road when that first pop hit the car. Now, there was confusion in the car, and you can see that from the footage. I thought it was a flat tire. I thought maybe we'd punctured the tire and it went boom. Stuart straight away said, no, that was a bullet. But there was a bit of a confusion and our car sort of rolled forward. It's hard to describe. And there was a few seconds and suddenly just a volley of bullets into the vehicle. We were really confused and shocked, as you might imagine, at that moment.
I have a lot of serious questions about that moment. But Stuart, did you have a bite of ice cream before you got shot?
Do you know what? I wasn't actually relaxed at all. I took a little bit of the ice cream and I actually put it into a little bag and put it away.
It's almost like you felt asked, there was something wrong. You felt like there might be danger.
I did feel something was wrong and I kicked myself afterwards because I asked the policeman if it was a good direction, but I didn't ask him when he had last travelled it. And that is the oldest one in the book. And so it was when he travelled it probably fine, but that had changed. I think it's Dominic makes a very important point here. The battle space was changing absolutely constantly. So the roads that we had travelled on suddenly weren't safe. They had been very safe. There was fighting taking place in three locations, which we found ourselves almost surrounded by. So we didn't have many options. And we had to go down this road, which did not look great, but it seemed to be the best, if not only, option we had at that stage. And then, of course, the round started coming in, and it was absolutely relentless. Interestingly, I think that certainly Dominic, Richie and I felt that it was a mistake, that it was possibly a poor Ukrainian unit that had just started opening up on a car, because other media teams had problems at checkpoints in the previous days. So we started shouting that we were press, etc., but in a stop in the fighting. And then the shooting then increased. In fact, it definitely increased. You can hear it in the tape. It was almost as if they decided, right, we really are going to finish this lot off. And I have to say, being in the back of the car, I was just watching the windscreen disappear, holes appear in the roof, the dashboard fell off. I mean, it was absolutely incredible. I kept thinking, you know, I am going to die, I think. I wonder if it's going to hurt. And then I got hit, and it didn't hurt as bad as I thought it was going to. And after that, we were all slowly but surely made our way out of the car, albeit under fire. So it was very,
so you had time to think, how bad is it going to hurt, assuming you're about to be shot before you're shot?
I was absolutely convinced I was going to die. I didn't think there was any chance the amount of rounds that were coming into that car are going to continue to miss. They kept hitting things. You kept seeing sparks flying off, tracers going. And what really marked it out from other ambushes I've been in the past, and I have been shot at many, many times in cars, many of us who do this sort of job have been, What was different is that this was absolutely zeroed on us. They weren't missing. They were smashing the car up bit by bit, which is quite unusual. And that was the sort of real indicator, oh dear. But not least that the shooting intensified, but also this is really, you know, they know exactly what they're doing. This is not like your normal sort of militia. So I thought, this is it. And will it hurt? And that's when I got hit. And as I say, I was lucky. It didn't hurt as much as I thought, but I'm sure that's the adrenaline, of course, which is a remarkable thing. And then I picked up my phone, stepped out of the car, and you can hear Richie saying, what are you doing? Because apparently I stand up. And then moved towards the edge of the embankment where Dominique is already down with the other members of the team. And I pretty much dropped sort of 20 or 30 feet, probably onto my head, probably knocked myself out. We don't really know. And then Richie joined us a little time later.
Right, so you all are fleeing the car, trying to seek shelter down a hillside, and you don't really remember the details of those moments once you're wounded, it sounds like.
No, I don't recall standing up. It sounds so ridiculous, but I mean, I pretty much remember everything. You know, actually, the truth of it, Brian, as I said, it is actually all on film. So, you know, whether I do or don't remember them, I know what I've seen and heard, and it's all, my brain has certainly put it all back together again. But I think certainly after falling down and seeing Richie arrive, I'm pretty hazy. So, like I say, I'm pretty certain I knocked myself out. But, I mean, I was wearing armour, I had my helmet on, so it hurt, but it was never going to kill me. And then I was quite proud of the team because we all pulled together quite well, single file, made our way to find cover. And of course, although we found cover, if you like this, as often the case in these scenarios, the initial incident is horrendous, but you survive it. And then it just gets worse and worse because now there's a huge fight taking outside. We're hiding in a garage, ostensibly, no idea what's going on, and no idea if anyone's going to be able to even come and rescue us. And are we now actually the front line? And I think for some hours, effectively, we were stuck, and there were very few options available to us but to basically hunker down and hope somebody would come.
So being shot was not the scariest moment?
No, I would say being shot was, well, I think the scariest moment was being on the back seat watching the car slowly disintegrate. But after that, it was very, very scary. And Dominique, I'm sure you'll say so as well, you'll speak for yourself. But when we were in that garage, that was like thinking, wow, this is trouble because it is not going away. As I say, the fighting outside, we don't know who was fighting. We're assuming the shooters were engaged by a Ukrainian army unit who may have come to see what all the firing was about, and it turned into a firefight, but it went on for a really long time. But it was far too dangerous to go outside and see. And obviously, I was degrading quite quickly now. I was bleeding, not heavily, but we hadn't had any water, and I was feeling pretty ill, and we all had terrible shock, as you might imagine. So it was a real matter of trying to sort of hold on.
Yeah, that's what I was about to ask Dominique. What condition is Stuart in as you're trying to get him to safety?
Yeah, I mean, Stuart points out that he didn't quite feel very, you know, he felt a little bit out of it, mainly because he felt when he fell down the embankment, he got a bit of concussion. And so in this moment, obviously, my first thought is, how badly injured is he? You know, how bad is that bullet wound? You know, we know there's a clear entry wound through the top of his leg. It's come out through his lower back. What does that wound look like? You know, what is now the risk factor? Are we more in danger here, being here in this spot? Do we need to find cover first before we check Stuart and that kind of thing? And, you know, as Martin Vowles, a producer who works with us, who was also there, said, well, it was really a matter of weighing up, okay, he's walking, he's talking, he's breathing. Our first priority is to get to safety. Our second priority is to check that injury. And I think that Stuart was remarkably calm, remarkably held together, considering he had just been shot and considering we'd all just gone through this horrific experience. And as he said, it was showing no signs of stopping.
And let's be clear, you were all wearing some form of body armor, right, Stuart?
Yes. I mean, body armor, I think public have an idea of what they look like. If they've ever seen a police officer, they know what body armor looks like. It actually only covers your vital organs and your chest. So anything below it, and obviously your head above it and your arms, isn't covered. Because of the position I had and the position of where the bullet came, it came basically into my lower part of my body, which, you know, can cause awful problems. And certainly if the bullet had hit some bone, it could have disappeared any direction beneath the body armor. So that was why I was hit. But that's where I was hit and why it wasn't so bad, which is how they're designed. Because, you know, otherwise you'd be walking around like sort of like Ned Kelly. You know, you have to have some movement. That is why. But we are all wearing armor. It saved Richie's life. We're under no doubt about that.
Yeah, that's why I was asking. I'm thinking, what is it like for Richie to be moving all around with you all after this attack? And he knows that this body armor saved his life.
Yeah, and he actually had quite a bad back as well by this point, probably from the percussion of the bullets, but also from his escape, which was down the bank and as well. He's a very fit guy. I suspect his body overflexed, so his back is quite badly hurt. And he's also having had a procedure in hospital as well to try and sort out some of the nerve damage he has. But, he was very fortunate. But he was very much part of the team and very good at sort of very experienced, and we sort of gathered together. If a member was feeling a bit dodgy, as in my case, everyone made sure that we sort of stuck together. That was very important that we stuck together.
Yeah. Stuart mentioned.
Scary.
Go ahead, Dominic.
No, sorry, I was just going to say, Brian, the scary thing actually is, in the aftermath, we've all sort of looked at bits of our clothing that we were wearing at the time and sort of just noticed bullet holes, you know, that we hadn't even seen. Richie had a couple of bullet holes through the hood of his jacket, you know, for starters, and sort of holes in Stuart's, you know, just in bits of loose clothing. I mean, I just can't get closer than that. And at the time, of course, you know, we weren't inspecting our clothes, but since being home, looking at bits of our clothing, it's just a little bit mind-blowing.
I read you say that all the bullets flying everywhere, it felt like being in a washing machine full of bullets. Had you ever thought about what that moment might be like in, you know, earlier in your career? Was it what you expected, so to speak?
No, I mean, to be honest with you, working in war zones, we sort of take a template of war and you work out what your biggest risks are, and always airstrikes and air power and artillery are really your biggest concerns. You know, the places where ambushes happen the most is working in Africa. So unless, you know, you're working in a conflict zone in Africa, you don't really consider it a big risk. Ambush, by definition, you're not meant to see coming. Well, we didn't see it coming. I had never imagined that I would ever be in an ambush, and that it was something I'd only ever read about it and thought it was such a rare and abnormal thing to happen that the chances of it happening were incredibly low. But you're absolutely right. It did feel like being in a washing machine with bullets. Of course, the car wasn't turning. But what I mean by that is the bullets were everywhere. And although the camera the camera is showing one angle. It's showing the angle from the front of the car where Richie is huddled in the footwell of the front passenger seat. I'm huddled in the footwell of the back passenger seat. And as Stuart says, he's sort of, you know, just taking as much cover as he can on the back of the seat. But the bullets are everywhere. I mean, they're just flying. And it did feel like what I would imagine would be, you know, to be sort of going round and round in a washing machine with things just pinging everywhere. It was impossible to, I don't even know how I wasn't hit. And it was impossible to think that you weren't going to be shot. It was almost like a guarantee.
Did combat training kick in? I'm sure you all have had combat training to be in war zones. Do you feel like you benefited from that past training in those moments?
I personally know for a fact it did. I mean, I have been doing wars for a very long time, and I have been in some pretty awful scrapes. I've been blown up, and I've been taken hostage and stuff like that. But this is by far the worst because of the professional nature of it, the intent to kill us. There's no doubting the intent. But I touched on it before. Yeah, the training did. We knew we had to debus, as it's called, which is to get out of the car. We knew how to try our best to choose a time. You can't really, to be honest. You just think it's the time. You actually make the time to go. It's not really, you're not waiting on their decision. You're making your own. But you know, we knew how to do that. We knew to regroup, however. We knew to take cover. We knew to move quickly. We knew that I needed to be checked. You know, the team needed to check at least as quickly as possible what was the matter with me. We knew we had to get indoors as soon as possible. We knew then also, and this is the important bit, is, you know, I had the phone, but we had, you know, we do have people watching out for us back in this case, in Lviv, who were seeing our trackers. All of these things, you know, the trackers could tell where we were. Even if we hadn't rung them, they would have known within half an hour that our trackers have not moved for half an hour. 1 hour later, they would be saying, OK, we've got a problem, and they're on a bridge. Something's wrong. So we knew that it would come. But all of those things kicked in, and it did, you know, it did work well. There's always going to be a review of procedures. We're extremely experienced team. All of us have a lot of medical training and combat training and combat experience. And we weren't looking for trouble. So you couldn't have asked basically for the best team to be hit. And it just goes to show that anyone can be hit. And as I say, really importantly, yes, lots of journalists have been hurt, but this is our job. What is outrageous is what is happening to civilians attacked exactly the same as us in exactly the same cars, let alone the thousands who have been forced out of their home or those who are being killed by aerial bombardments. But this individual attacking of people is a disgrace. And it is, to me, I don't think there's much doubt about it. It's a war crime, no doubt about it.
And by seeing it on camera, the rest of the world knows. And we're able to see it thanks to you and thanks to Richie. Thanks to you all for being there. Let's pick up the story. You're in the garage now. You're seeking shelter. Let's pick up right there after a quick break here on the podcast. More in just a moment.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back on the Reliable Sources podcast. I'm Brian Stelter, speaking with Sky News chief correspondent Stuart Ramsey and senior forum producer Dominique Van Heerden. Let's pick up the story in the garage. You all are seeking shelter, trying to get water and other essentials for Stuart, who is wounded in the leg. Dominique, how long were you all in that garage while hearing fighting around you?
We were in the garage for up to 4 hours, 3 to 4 hours. I couldn't tell you the exact time we were extracted, but when we got into the garage, it was still light. By the time we were out, it was dark. It was a good 3-4 hours. I would say, and of course, Stuart can correct me if he thinks differently, but I would say the fighting outside was at least half the time that we were in the garage. And it was intense. We in many ways, being in the car, we felt like we could do something for ourselves, which was get out. In the warehouse, we were very much sitting ducks, and it felt completely out of our hands. And I think that was the scariest bit. And for me, the most terrifying bit was being in that garage, not really knowing what might happen next. And with those firefights continuous going on outside, and then, of course, your mind starts sort of going to all sorts of places that you don't want it to go. Like Stuart said, we've just survived round one. Are we going to make it through round two? And I really, really actually started to feel, when I had those moments to think, that's when I started to feel a little upset by the whole thing, a little bit afraid, but also knowing that we had to stay on the phone with our colleagues who were talking to everybody they knew in the Ukrainian government and police forces and secret service and you name it, you know, trying to get us out. And we also knew we had a casualty on our hands, Stuart. And in those scenarios, actually, you put that fear aside, even though it can threaten to completely overwhelm your thinking. And you remember what you've learned, and you just do your best to keep it together. I know it sounds a bit simple, but there's not really much else you can do in that scenario. And so we did that in that warehouse. There were three lovely Ukrainian men who had seen us run into the complex and were kind of a bit confused about what these five journalists were running in, all injured, were doing. Just said, come, and brought us into their specific workshop. And they were very kind to us. And, you know, they gave me a coat. I didn't have a coat because my coat was in the car. And, you know, we did our best to make ourselves comfortable, to kind of wait out what would happen next.
Did you think that if Russian forces entered that area, that you all would be killed?
Oh, personally, yes.
I think that was our biggest fear, right, Stuart?
Yeah. I think we don't know exactly what happened, and I don't suspect it was the police involved. They were the police that eventually rescued us, but I suspect that this was actually another Ukrainian army or volunteer group. But we suspect that the Russians did advance from their positions, possibly to come and finish us off, but that then they found themselves engaged and probably withdrew to where they had come from. We know that from the police, chief of police, who we ended up spending the night with, that they had been identified as a problem in the area, and in fact it was contributed to why the bridge that we were driving towards had been blown, because they were trying to keep them on that side, if you like, on the Kiev side of this motorway. But we suspect that that's what they were intending to do. And we know from another media company, or at least what they have told us, that a family was shot in the same place a day later. The wife and daughter were killed. The father was allowed to leave with a baby, and they saved by Russian soldiers who advanced towards them. That means they didn't stay ambushed. So with that in mind, I suspect they were coming towards that that unit to try and finish us off. What I would say in our favour is that this unit is only one of a huge complex. So while we didn't think we could get out of where we were safely, we possibly could have hid, but it would have been only a matter of time if nobody had come to help us, that they would have found us. I'm pretty certain.
What you're raising is the fact that we don't know 100% who was firing at you. All signs point to the Russians.
All signs point to the Russians, not least because of the intelligence that we've been given by the police about their presence in the first place, but also the police that came to get us. And the police the next morning went to our position to try and retrieve passports and equipment, and came under intense fire from exactly the same place.
So when you're yelling press and the firing intensifies, that tells us something.
Well, it sort of does, doesn't it? I mean, we know that there's been concerns for some time that the press have specifically been targeted by the Russian forces. That is from incidents that happened after our incident, and we know that civilians have been attacked. But also, just quickly to say that the police, we've been with them for hours afterwards, but also we'd seen them operating over the days before. The militias and the police are very, very close. The Ukrainian forces are not fighting amongst each other. Also, that was a professional ambush, and we hadn't seen a checkpoint that I would describe as particularly professional for most of the day.
Mm. Dominique, you referenced the folks back home trying to help, the Sky News newsroom getting into action, the security teams trying to help, on the phone with Ukrainian sources. But because you're in Ukraine and there's not British or American troops, weren't you at a disadvantage? Meaning it's harder to get extracted or get rescued when there's not troops, when there's not military forces from your country there.
Look, I think in previous conflict situations we've been in, there is, of course, a degree of comfort, let's call it that, knowing, you know, that forces from your particular country are there. We were outside Kabul airport for over 10 days in August last year with the withdrawal of troops, and the American forces and British forces were right there. And although there were other threats, we felt a degree of security being around the American and British troops. Of course, in this case, that does not exist there. And the Ukrainian forces are stretched as it is. You know, they're fighting a much bigger army. And so therefore, yeah, of course, you feel that little bit more vulnerability, obviously. And I think what journalists who want to work in environments like these and sometimes do work in environments like these sometimes miss is that nobody is coming to save you. You know, you are there out of choice, and you have got as much training as you can possibly get, and you weigh up your risk rewards scale all the time about what it is you're doing. But ultimately, if you are in trouble, you have to do your best to get out of it. And we did that in the car scenario because that was on us. Once we fell back to that, you know, other position to take a bit more cover in the warehouse, we knew that our colleagues were just working overtime to find whatever solution they could. And I know they felt incredibly helpless. I mean, you can also imagine from their point of view, the trauma of talking to the team on the other side of the phone. Steward is shot. We've just been ambushed. We've been fired at hundreds of times. We don't have anything. We don't know where we are. We're in this warehouse. Their sense of helplessness, as you might imagine, is also pretty traumatic if you think about it. But I think what really made the difference, and we all know this, you know, the local journalists who work with us in these countries, they are basically secret weapons. They are amazing, you know. Their ability to understand the kind of anthem of war that you're in is actually what saved us in this instance, because it was our sort of super local fixer slash journalist extraordinaire who ended up pulling all the strings to get us out.
Mm. So how did that happen, Stuart? What was the evacuation like?
We had been there, as Dominique said, for some hours. We had a message back. I think it was a call that Dominique took saying the police will do their best to come and get you tomorrow. It was cold, really now suffering from lack of water. So we decided to go to a sort of administrative area within the garage, sort of upstairs. And it's a tin building, yeah, corrugated iron building. Tried to find some water, which we did, and actually got into a room, were able to shut a door and just thought, right, well, if we all just sit in here, we'll get warmer quite quickly, and we're just going to have to tough this one out. No lights on, just let's just sit quiet, and if you can sleep, sleep, otherwise, you know, just hold on. And knowing it's going to be an extremely long night. I was... Actually, it would work with me quite well because I was already beginning to slightly drift off. I suspect because I wasn't feeling very well, but I was drifting away, asleep. Suddenly, and I was talking to Richie about this, all we could hear were the sound of boots clumbering up these stairs and what clearly weapons banging against the metal of the building. And Richie said, "This is it. They have come, and we're finished." And then we heard these beautiful words, "We're Ukrainian police, hurry." And they bustled us downstairs, incredibly went through, asked for our press ID, and put us into the car. Because, of course, they don't know where we actually are, who we say we are. But anyway, they got us into the car, sped off at high speed out of the this warehouse unit and took us to the police station next to the checkpoint where we had been given ice cream some hours earlier, and they were very good. And we've since learned, Dominique, and you'll know more than this because you were speaking to us a lot, but we believe that the Secret Service had reason to believe something bad was going to happen there, right?
That's right. The Secret Service had actually got in touch of Ukraine, had got in touch directly with the governor's office of that region and the police force and said, "You have to go and get these journalists tonight. You just have to. You know, we have intelligence we can't share with you, but you have to go and get them tonight." And actually, Brian, you know, it was funny when Stuart was just saying we were taken back to the same police station. In that moment, it occurred to me, oh, right, of course. And by the way, that was 300 or 400 meters up the road. Can you imagine that there was such debate over coming to get us 300 or 400 meters away? That gives you a real indication of how dangerous that must have been at that point in time, because you would think, well, 300, 400 meters, it's less than a kilometer, we'll just do it. But no, I mean, there was a lot of thought even just for that distance and also being so close to safety, but actually being right, so far away from it at the same time. It's crazy.
For American viewers, a quarter of a mile to the police station. Yeah. But thankfully they were able to get you there. And then what happens in the days after? First of all, Stuart, you need to get out of Ukraine, right? Yes, you can have medical attention there, but I'm guessing you're going to want to get to a hospital at home.
Yeah, that was a primary concern. First concern was to get to Kiev, you know, just to try and get back from there. And that was going to be, that was a fair, fairly difficult thing. So they weren't sure where to keep us. They were going to keep us at the police station. We took a very dim view of this, although we were very grateful. It's like, by this stage, you're thinking the Russians are literally coming down the road. Well, we know they're down the road in one direction. And certainly the police station's going to get hit first. So we asked if they could go somewhere else. And they spoke to their boss and he said, listen, bring him to mine. And he welcomed us in, and he was great, actually. And we stayed the night with him while there was a lot of negotiation as to how we tried to get out. And eventually, I got cleaned up a little by a doctor and a nurse who had been put on duty to look after the police station. At this stage, none of them had been involved in the war. So I do remember being in the... Because I hadn't really got going, as you were saying. We're only a couple of days in at this stage.
You were there first. You were their first patient from the war. Wow.
100%. And actually, it's funny. I mean, the police took me to their room, which was, I think, in a sort of converted hotel, but, sort of. And I was in a room, and there must have been about 10, 15 people in there. And the doctor pulled my trousers down, and all 15 people did one of Coast Collectors. It was like I was looking around saying, thanks very much, guys. It doesn't get any worse. So then they just basically poured iodine on it, patched me up, and there was like not much you can do. And so the focus for us then, for Dominique, who was doing all the coordinating with Martin, was to try and get us back to a point where we could meet up with our other team members who were in Kyiv and actually get taken back to the city. And from there, to get to Lviv. Now, Lviv, at that point, we did the drive a day or so later, I think, Dominique. It was 18 and a half hours. So, it wasn't great for everyone, no.
And the surgery that you had just recently, what was that surgery? What did you need to have done?
What they needed to do was to go in, if you like, I'm not going to get too graphic, but obviously there's an in point and an out point, and if you like it, there's a lot of flesh in between that's got basically a tube of flesh in it that needs to come out because you could get sepsis quite quickly from it. I'd had a lot of antibiotics. So effectively what they did was to go in and remove it. I don't want to say too graphic, but just a bit. Imagine an apple core being taken out of an apple. That's basically what they did.
Wow.
And then stitched me back up. It's very clever. I was really fortunate. The senior consultant on duty at the hospital in Oxford is a former military surgeon who'd served in Afghanistan, so he knew exactly what he was doing with a gun wound, bullet wound, because most of the surgeons that I spoke to when I first got home couldn't really touch it because they said it's just out of their skill. You know, if I'd had a knife in the stomach, they could do something. A bullet to the back, they don't know anything about. That's Britain for you. We don't really have that very often. But he luckily was on duty and that was all sorted out. So I'm very eternally grateful to them, obviously, and to all the people who got us out, which is fantastic.
Yeah. Dominique, even before you all were out of the country, I believe it's when you arrived back in Kyiv that you saw other journalists from other outlets, other networks, including the Fox News cameraman who later died in Ukraine. Tell me about seeing Pierre.
Yeah, Brian, that's a tough one, you know, because as we were sitting here speaking, I was sort of thinking to myself, Stuart and I have talked about this and our team, can you imagine that what happened to us was the good outcome, you know? And Stuart and Pierre are very good mates, and I knew him just from being around the road. You know, and he was the first person who sought us out and said, guys, what happened? You know, are you okay? And big hugs. And, you know, he, in pure Pierre style, just caring more about everybody else and everything else, you know, and just sort of kind of, you know, a nice slap on the back. And I'm so glad you're okay. And one of the last things anyway I said to him was, thank you so much. And please take care. You know, this war is crazy. It's something different about it to what we know. And, I would say that actually the hardest bit of our recovery, mentally at least, has been, you know, in that first week or so, it was the elation about being alive, and that's great. But then when you hear about your colleagues killed, and it really brings it home to you just how fortunate we were. And then it just makes you wonder why were we okay that day and some aren't? I don't know. I mean, who knows? But yeah, Pierre, you know, an amazing guy, and so many amazing journalists and others doing what they do in Ukraine. And I don't think that I hope people understand the price that journalists pay, you know, to bring them the truth, because in Ukraine right now, it's a very high price, not just for us, but for all the others.
Very well said. I wonder, Stuart, if you remember your final conversation with Pierre.
I do, Brian. Sorry, I can't go there, mate. Sorry.
I respect that.
Thank you.
When I read about that Fox crew coming under fire, I thought about you all right away. You know, because at first, the Fox said that correspondent Benjamin Hall had been injured, and they didn't talk about Pierre or Sasha because they were missing. And then news outlets like CNN tried to find them. We all started working together trying to find them. But it sounded like kind of similar to your all's experience. We don't really know all the full details about what happened to that crew, but time and time again, yeah, for the last month, we've seen these news crews come under attack. And it really does underscore what you said, Dominique, about how lucky you all were. It didn't feel lucky in the moment, but how lucky you all were.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what happened to Brent and the team who'd been doing some work for Time, you know, as well, a few days before the Fox incident. That sounds almost identical, actually, to what happened to us. And in his case, you know, he had one bullet wound through the neck. And that's all it takes, is one bullet that's gone in the wrong place. And that's it, you know. And so, yes, we are absolutely, absolutely so lucky. I can't tell you why, Brian. I can't even tell you how. But we're here and we're telling the story. And maybe it's twofold. Maybe it's so that civilians have a voice as well, sort of through our story. It's given them a voice, what's happening to them. But equally, you know, in this age of fake news, I think actually what makes me more afraid than even what happened to us is this whole idea that misinformation and fake news can somehow outdo the truth. And it felt like this and this visceral account of our experience was just the kind of counterbalance that is needed right now to all of the misinformation that was coming out of Russia. Yeah. And so I think as scary as it was for us, we're proud that the piece is out there, because hopefully maybe it provides some kind of understanding of that.
Definitely. Stuart, I was just thinking, it's been 30 years for you at Sky News. You mentioned all the scrapes you've been in before. You know, in 2017, wasn't it? You know, or 2007, your team in Mosul, you know, narrowly survived a car bombing. You've had these episodes, and this is the worst of them all. Does it make you want to stay at home? Does it make you want to?
No, you know, I've been asked this question quite a lot. And, you know, without getting all highfalutin, Brian, if you actually believe that your job is to bear witness to awful things that happen to ordinary people who need a voice, then that's your job. And I do believe that. And so do all the friends of ours who are working there right now, and all those who have died before, because it is what we do. It is difficult. There are many rewards to this amazing job. We don't spend our whole lives being blown up or shot. And so there are some great benefits to it. But it is, we take it really seriously, again, without sounding, you know, all a bit too happy and chuffed with ourselves. The point is, it is something we do, and we do genuinely believe that we have to go out there and report on it. And my friends who work for CNN, who I know very, very well, and who are out there now, think exactly the same. We don't talk about it a great deal, but we all know. And people say, oh, well, you're adrenaline junkies. You've got to trust me. I'm the least adrenaline junkie guy you'll ever meet. I get very scared of going into wars. Just happen to be able to work in the environment. I have no idea why, but I don't mind it too much. And I know that I can rest afterwards. And we've got to go. You've got to go back, because if we don't, they get away with it. And if they get away with it, then no one's safe. And likewise, and Dominique is absolutely 100% right. People are still saying that what happened to us isn't real, that it's fake. It's absolutely incredible. There's metadata, there's anything you can see, visual references, interviews you can have to show we were where we were and we were shot. And people still say it's made up. So, you know, people have got to keep going. People who are trusted news sources, people have got to trust us. We've got to earn that trust. And to earn that trust, we have to go to these places. And to do the best we can, report accurately, and truthfully. Because if we don't, then you'll never know what's going on in this world.
When you're fully healed, do you think you'll go back to Ukraine?
100%. 100%. It will take a little while. Obviously, you know, the physical side is fine. you know, it's, mentally I'm going to be a bit shaky. I don't know if I'm going to be driving down a road straight away on my own or just with the team. But I feel a responsibility for us to go back. You don't have to be right at the front line to do a very important story, which is about the people who are themselves trying to flee the front line. So we'll have a little look at that. But I'm absolutely determined to go back here.
And Dominique?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a conversation that we've had. Yeah, absolutely. As I said, yes, what happened to us was terrifying, terrorizing, call it what you will. But I do think that I wouldn't feel right not ever returning to Ukraine again or not going back. And as Stuart says, there's people stories to be done as well. So we can measure, we can do our whole risk reward, as I keep talking about. We can see how we feel, but I think we all feel really determined to go back, and we'll know when the time is right, and we definitely will. Yeah.
Dominique and Stuart, thank you both for the conversation. Stuart, glad to hear you're feeling better.
Thank you, thanks, Brian.
Thank you. Just an absolutely extraordinary recounting of the ambush and all that followed. Our thanks to Sky News and to Stuart and Dominique for joining us here on the podcast. We'll see you on television this Sunday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time on CNN, and weekdays, 11 a.m. on CNN Plus for Reliable Sources Daily. Thank you for tuning in.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.